Okay. Proverbs 12. One of the things, a lot of these ideas in Proverbs 12 will go together. One of the things that we'll see is that the house of the righteous man, the house of the righteous will stand firm. God will make sure that his righteous are living on a solid foundation if they come to him. Now granted, it is our responsibility to strive to be righteous, but if we seek his ways, he will bless us. He will help us and be with us and help us through this life. Verse 1, we talked about it a little bit last week. Let's just go ahead and read it and then we'll break it down because it gives just one of these great comparisons. Whoever loves instruction loves knowledge, but he who hates correction is stupid. And we'll come back to the second part. That part really stands out when we read it. But let's talk about the first part. Whoever loves instruction loves knowledge. Immediately, think of the Bereans. Acts chapter 17, Paul comes to them. He teaches them. What is their reaction when he teaches them? Yeah, but this is Paul. This is an apostle coming to him and bringing this word. Surely they'll just accept whatever he says. Not the Bereans. They take what he said. They take the teaching. And they want the teaching. They readily receive it. But then they take it and compare it against Scripture. And when they find those things to be so, then they embrace it. The exact same thing that you and I should do. Every time we hear teaching, we should be ready for it. We should be wanting to hear it. But then when we hear it taught, what do we do with it? Yeah. First thing, we compare it to God's word to make sure it is so, to make sure it's true. And if we find it to be true, then we apply it to our lives. Then we make it part of us. And it doesn't matter who teaches it. Right? If it's not in line with God's word, we can't accept it. Even if it's someone that we've trusted for years and years and years and they've always taught truth, and here they come and they bring error, I can't say, well, you know, hey, I mean, I've known him for 20 years. I love him so much. I'm just going to let that slide. I can't accept that, you know. And he needs to be talked to about that. So, again, we need to have that same spirit that the Bereans had. Do we love instruction from God's Word? Do we truly love it like they did? Do we receive it with readiness? Now, let's look at the second part of the verse. But he who hates correction is stupid. I know that word. There are a lot of parents here who don't want your children using the word stupid because they'll take it and use it in a way that just sounds awful coming off their lips. Everything will be stupid. They'll use it all the time. There are a lot of parents who just have kind of banned that word. I understand that completely. But who's using it here? Yeah. So he's using it right. We know the way he's using it, it's absolutely appropriate. So let's look and see what he's talking about. The man who refuses to hear correction. That means the man who refuses to have his ways questioned. What's he doing? I heard somebody think he's being stupid. Yeah, he is. He's not ignorant, right? There's a difference between ignorance and stupidity. Ignorance is a lack of knowledge that can be fixed. Stupid doesn't want to be fixed. Stupid wants to be stupid. It wants to stay where it is because it likes it. That's the difference between those two. Steve, yeah.
Well, if you're talking about the Scriptures, they're putting, and then they don't want to listen to the correction. They're placing themselves on the level of God.
Yeah. Their advice is suddenly greater in their eyes than his. Yeah. Extremely dangerous. Roy, did you have a comment? Oh, okay. Any other thoughts on that? Yeah, Chuck.
English Standard states it as hates reproof.
But he who hates
reproof.
Yeah.
So that's just showing not only do they not want to hear it, but they hate anybody even coming at them trying to correct them.
Yeah. Yeah. You almost get a sense of anger and arrogance about it. How dare you bring that to me and correct me?
Who are you to correct me?
Yeah, great. Great point. Good. Yeah, Brian.
I'm involved in instruction on a daily basis on a simulator. And we have a saying that we always say when we get in the instructor's room, you can't teach stupid. And you can't instruct stupid.
Yeah.
It's that attitude.
Yeah. Yeah. you know, it has nothing to do with somebody's intellectual capabilities. Stupid is a heart problem. And until it gets past that, it doesn't matter how smart they are. It doesn't matter what their IQ is. Until they're willing to learn and willing to be corrected. I mean, you're talking to a wall. You can't get through to that until the heart changes. Really good point, Brian. Okay, good. Let's look at 2 and 3. A good man obtains favor from the Lord, but a man of wicked intentions he will condemn. A man is not established by wickedness, but the root of righteousness cannot be moved. True stability, true success comes from being rooted, from being anchored. We see that verse used in the New Testament, being anchored in the Lord. Mark your places there, but let's turn to Matthew 7. Matthew 7, if I could get someone to read verses 24 through 27.
Everyone then who hears these words of mine does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house. But it did not fall, because it has been founded on the rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat against the house, and it fell. And great was that fall.
Okay, just this great section. And we're in the life of Christ now in our evening study, and we'll spend a lot more time on this when we get here. But just to quickly look at some ideas presented there, the whole focus are the words of Christ. That's what's being built on. If that's what you build on, if that's your foundation, what state is that person in? The man, the woman who would build on the words of Christ, that would be the foundation of their life. What shape are they in? It's solid. Completely solid foundation. Now, just because you're faithful to the Lord, does that mean you won't have any problems? Now, I mean, look at verse 25. The rain descended, the floods came, the winds blew and beat on that house. So did problems still come? Yeah, I mean, problems like everybody else, maybe more problems than other people, because Satan certainly doesn't want that faithful person to stay there. But through the midst of all that, the foundation's firm. The foundation is solid. The anchor is solid. Now compare the other one. The one who hears the sayings of Jesus, hears his words, and he just refuses to do them. He's like a man who builds his foundation on what? We know what happens there. There's nothing solid. And then when those things come, the foundation just falls apart. And that's really a comparison between godliness and worldliness. We build our life on godliness, strong foundation. We build it on worldliness, just seeps through our fingers. It's sand, to use the example here. Same idea as we read back in Proverbs 12. Let's turn back there. Any comments on verses 2 or 3? Chip.
But it's like in the Matthew, it's like, they have the instruction. They know what they need to do.
Yeah.
But intentionally do different.
Yeah.
That's the biggest difference there. I mean, the stupidity that comes into it is where they completely refuse to do what they know they should.
So in the example of Matthew, it goes back to Proverbs 12, verse 1. Again, you've got whoever loves instruction, loves knowledge, he's built with that strong foundation. And then the one who rejects it, he's purposely ignoring God's way and bringing all kinds of trouble to himself. Good. Okay, let's look at verse 4. An excellent wife is the crown of her husband, but she who causes shame is like rottenness in his bones. An excellent wife is the crown of her husband. She brings honor to him. She brings goodness and beauty to his life in so many different ways. Is she a source of strength to her husband?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely she is. Just mentioned times before, before I get up to preach, you guys who know me, I'm kind of all over the place. I'm nervous sometimes. Sasha will just tap me on the knee. And there it is. And just that little encouragement that nobody else even has to see. Wives can strengthen their husbands, make them so much stronger, so much better in so many different ways. An excellent wife does that. What does she do when it comes to truth? An excellent wife. Talking about a godly woman here.
She
he encourage them to stick to the truth?
And even if he doesn't, what will she do?
She'll stick to herself.
She's going to do it right either way, because she trusts in the Lord first and foremost. Even if her husband wouldn't, she would continue to do what's right. She would continue to serve the Lord. What does she do for the home? For their home?
Helps build the spiritual base for the whole family.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We could talk about the physical things that are done, and there are, we could spend the rest of the time naming those things. They are truly important. But she builds that spiritual foundation too. And you see, go ahead, Jim.
And that's another very important reason for a Christian to seek out a Christian wife. Because if you seek out a Christian wife, you both have the same goals to go to heaven.
Yeah.
So you can build upon each other to build your family up. And the whole, like a rope, all of you intertwined are a lot stronger than if you have one that's faithful and one that's not.
Yeah. Especially when children get involved and you're working in the same direction instead of working against each other. Absolutely. Again, mark your places there. Let's turn back in Proverbs. Let's turn to Proverbs 31. We won't spend a ton of time on this section, because when we get to Proverbs 31, we're going to spend a lot of time on it. But just to read through some of the things in this description of a virtuous wife and an excellent woman. Proverbs 31, verse 10, beginning. Who could find a virtuous wife? For her worth is far above rubies. The heart of her husband safely trusts her, so he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. She seeks wool and flax and willingly works with her hands. She's like the merchant ship. She brings her food from afar. She also rises while it is yet night and provides food for her household and a portion for her maidservants. She considers a field and buys it. From her profits, she plants a vineyard. She girds herself with strength and strengthens her arms. She perceives that her merchandise is good and her lamp does not go out by night. She stretches out her hands to the distaff, and her hand holds the spindle. She extends her hand to the poor, yet she reaches out her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of snow for her household, for all her household is clothed with scarlet. She makes tapestry for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. She makes linen garments and sells them and supplies sashes for the merchants. Strength and honor are her clothing. She shall rejoice in time to come. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and on her tongue is the law of kindness. She watches over the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Many daughters have done well, but you excel them all. Charm is deceitful and beauty is passing, but a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her the fruit of her hands, and let her own works praise her in the gates. What an incredible testament to a godly woman. What a description. And again, not going to break it all down, but her husband trusts her, right? He does not worry about, well, what's she going to do? He trusts in her completely. His heart trusts in her, and he entrusts his household to her care. He knows whatever he puts in her hand, a godly woman, she's going to take care of it. She's going to do what is best for her family. God adores women like this. He absolutely does. And instead of working against the husband, they're working together. And as Chuck pointed out, for spiritual things first and foremost. But does she take care of the physical too? A ton of that description was the physical things she did. And a lot of those intertwine together, as Chuck mentioned. This is a beautiful picture. This woman will bless her children. She'll be a blessing to them. Her husband, if he has any sense whatsoever, he understands what a treasure that he has. Her price is far, far above rubies. Beautiful picture. And as beautiful as it is, as we come back to Proverbs 12, verse 4, now you have the flip side of it. And as nice as that was to talk about, the second half of the verse is not pleasant in any way. But she who causes shame, a shameful woman, is like rottenness in his bones. There's some beautiful imagery in Proverbs 31. And there's some imagery here too. What does rottenness do to bones?
Decay.
Yeah. What can you do on, what kind of work can you do on rotten bones? It's just going to fall apart. Yeah, I mean, there's no substance, there's no strength there. It saps the very strength out of the bones. It weakens them, makes them unable to fulfill their purpose, however you want to say that. It's dangerously unhealthy, too. And certainly you can make a spiritual application from that. The woman who would bring shame, spiritually speaking, dangerous to her family. Bobby, I think you had, yeah.
I'm thinking about what Job's wife tried to do.
Yeah.
She asked him to reseal your name, his integrity, asked him, why don't you cuss God and die? But that was the wrong kind of advice.
Oh, yeah. And we don't see Job taking it either. But good. Any other comments on that? Joe?
The rottenness of the bones almost makes me think of it starts off subtle, like it's a internal thing, like it's not something that's like visibly to just the public or whatever, and it just so slowly rots away and makes it worse and worse as time goes on.
Yeah, it could be something too, and the point about it getting growing, you know, certainly that would happen, and the rot would continue to grow and grow. That's true. Very good point. Okay, let's look at the next section, verses 5 through 8, and we'll sort of talk about all of them as a group. Someone to read Proverbs 12, verses 5 through 8 for us, please.
The thoughts of the righteous are right. The counsels of the wicked are deceitful. The words of the wicked are lying wait for blood. But the mouth of the upright will deliver them. The wicked are overthrown and are no more. The house of righteousness will stand. A man will be commended according to his wisdom, but he who is of a perverse heart will be despised.
Okay, thank you, Andy. Let's just kind of take this section together sort of quickly. Just you've got these immediate contrasts there. In verse 5, it's talking about the difference in the thoughts. The thoughts of the righteous are right. They are just. They're pure. They're good in God's sight. The thoughts of the wicked, the counsels of the wicked, are deceitful. So you have this polar opposite. Here you have truth and right and justice versus deceit and dishonor and wickedness. So again, polar opposites in the way that the righteous and the wicked think. The next verse, verse 6, the things that come out of their mouth, the words of the upright will save them. They will deliver them from harm. What are the words of the wicked in that verse? Verse 6. What do the wicked say? Yeah, it's the exact opposite. The mouth of the upright will deliver them from harm. The words that come out of the wicked's mouths seek to do harm to others. So again, that contrast. Verse 7, the difference in reward. The house of the righteous will stand. It will stand firm. The wicked, the house of the wicked, it's overthrown. It is no more. If you actually go back to chapter 10, verse 25, when the whirlwind passes by, the wicked is no more, but the righteous has an everlasting foundation. So again, that same idea being presented here. And then in verse 8, their reputation. A man will be commended according to his wisdom. People will recommend him. People will trust him. People will promote him and give him more responsibility. What about the one who has a perverse heart, who has a corrupt heart? When people know it, how do they feel about him?
Can't trust him.
They know. They know. He's despised. He's completely untrustworthy. Good. Any thoughts on that section? Okay, let's look at 9. Better is the one who is slighted but has a servant than he who honors himself but lacks bread. So here you have a man who's not highly esteemed. He doesn't have a great name necessarily among the people. Nobody brags about him. Nobody talks about how great he is. But he has a servant. In other words, he has the physical means to provide for himself and his family. He has what he needs. He's taken care of. Then you have another man. He builds himself up as if he were someone extremely important. But what's the problem?
He's deceiving him.
Yeah. And he doesn't even have bread to eat. So he's built himself up as being someone great. And yet, he really doesn't have anything at all. I mean, you think of... go ahead, Steve.
Today we call it living beyond the means.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. You can have someone who... You know... If you spend all your money on a Lamborghini, and you can't eat that week. What's the point? Why would somebody do that? Do people do that sort of thing? Yeah, they do. They do that. Why would somebody do that?
They want to look good to other people.
It is all about the image that they want to be seen as something important, somebody important, something special. And they're willing to take the real substance out of their life to get that. And as Steve pointed out, the whole thing's hollow, though, because what's going to happen eventually?
Can't take it with you.
Even if you manage to keep that charade up to the end of your life, you're certainly not going to be able to take it with you. More than likely, it's not going to last very long at all because, I mean, in this case, you can drive whatever you want to. If you're not eating well, what good is the car going to do you? You know, all of these physical things, eventually it's going to catch up with you. And then the whole lie comes crashing down. And then you have absolutely nothing to show for it. Just shows, I think one of the things we can take from this, it's not specifically stated, but it's the idea of being content. Being content with what we have and making the most of it, realizing it's a blessing from God, and not trying to be something that we're not. As Steve pointed out, not trying to live beyond our means. Very dangerous, and we've seen that. Certainly the book of Proverbs addresses financial matters from time to time like that, and this can tie in with that as well.
You lie to yourself and you deceive others.
And, you know, if you lie to yourself long enough, you will start to believe it. You will start to believe it as truth, and that just leads to a whole host of other problems. Yeah. Verse 10 makes an interesting point. A righteous man regards the life of his animal, but the tender mercies of the wicked are cruel. A righteous man regards the life of his animal. What do you get from that verse? What does this tell us about the righteous?
Careful.
Yeah.
Have mercy.
Yeah. A good man understands God's blessings in whatever form they come. And in that sense, is that animal, is that a blessing? Is that something that he's been entrusted with? He's been given as a steward over? We're to be good stewards of whatever it is. And we may not think of it in this sense. Certainly this is likely a work animal. But in whatever case, you take care of those things that have been placed within your hand. You do right by them. What does the wicked do?
He's cruel.
His tenderest of mercies are cruel. Can you imagine when he's vindictive? I mean, he's a man who doesn't care. He has no respect for the blessings that God has given him. He just doesn't care. And he's cruel and without mercy in his actions. I thought I saw a hand. Yeah, Bobby.
I was thinking about Balaam in Numbers chapter 22. He had a donkey that he was riding when he was going and trying to get himself a good name when he shouldn't have gone. And the donkey saw the angel with the sword. Balaam didn't see it. But the donkey fell down to keep from getting killed by the angel. And Balaam told the donkey if he had a sword in his hand, he would have killed him. Well, the donkey was protecting himself and Balaam.
Yeah.
And Balaam didn't see it until it was too late.
Yeah. He had more sense than his master, and certainly in that case. Yeah. Any other thoughts on any of the verses we've talked through 10 so far? Okay. Let's look at 11 and 12. He who tills his land will be satisfied with bread, but he who follows frivolity is devoid of understanding. The wicked covet the catch of evil man, but the root of the righteous yields fruit. Again, I think you're dealing with contentment here. The man who works diligently will be satisfied. He'll receive a reward from his labor. But the man who constantly chases after these schemes, and you think get-rich schemes and having his head in the clouds, what's he like? Yeah, he's foolish, and he just keeps grasping after all of these plans, and he never really settles and does the work. He's not diligent in hard work. He's just completely ungrounded. So many people spend time chasing fantasies. They don't actually do the work that's needed to to provide. Bobby?
Remind me of somebody who don't want to work, but they want to play the lottery and get rich.
Big dreams. Big dreams. Verse 12. The wicked covet the catch of evil men. And you really get this idea that they look for a way to ensnare others to get gain from them. They just sort of use others for what can be gotten out of them. Those gains don't last. But you've got the comparison with the righteous. The righteous yields real fruit. Talk about this in the previous chapter. Someone, even if they don't have a lot of material wealth, can they be happy? You know, godly people who may not have a lot physically are the happy people, people you want to be around. You know, they're godly people. They love the Lord. They love their brethren. And again, you just see this difference in attitude here. Can we be content with whatever it is we have? God may bless us physically. He may give us a lot of physical blessings. I do need to understand if He does, I need to use it in a way that would please Him. It's not just so I can do whatever I want to. It comes with responsibility. So again, we see both sides of that. Let's stop there for a second and drop down to 24. I want to look at 24 through the end of the chapter, and then we'll come back and look at the others. 24 through 28. Someone could read those for us.
The hand of the diligent will rule, while the slothful will be put to forced labor. Anxiety in a man's heart weighs him down, but a good word makes him glad. One who is righteous is a guide to his neighbor, but the way of the wicked leads them astray. Whoever is slothful will not roast his gain, but the diligent man will get precious wealth. In the path of righteousness is life, and in the pathway there is no death.
Okay, good. 24. The hand of the diligent will rule, but the lazy man will be put to forced labor. Diligence is rewarded. If you're working in a company, and let's say you are over people, you are a manager, who are you looking to promote?
Those that work hard and that you can trust.
Yeah, the diligent and the trustworthy. Those you know that they're going to put forth all the effort they can. Do you know, has anybody at a manager's meeting ever said, I tell you what, Lance is so lazy. That's the guy we need to promote. That's the guy we need to have in charge. That's the guy we want out there with our customers. He's the face of the company. He's so sorry. If he shows up, we'll promote him today. Nobody does that. You don't want a lazy man to have that kind of reward. You don't trust him. Going back to what Chuck said, he's not diligent. He may be here, he may not. He'll probably quit tomorrow if you say the wrong thing to him. So that there's, you don't entrust them with a position of leadership or authority or responsibility, certainly. There's no honor that comes with that kind of behavior. Chuck?
Well, there again, that goes back to the world also. Because I have seen many times where management did promote those who were the sorry ones simply because they had good people that were already doing the work and they didn't want the good work to suffer by moving them up into the management type position. That happens time and time again.
I can't imagine that works out well, though. You know, it really, you just can't imagine that a company that frequently practiced that would be successful. You know, that it wouldn't cost them in a lot of different ways. 25 talks about an anxious heart weighing a man down. This anxiety, where do you think it stems from?
Worriedness.
Yeah, it seems, in the context of what else we've talked about, it seems that this anxiety comes from a lack of trusting in God and trying to sort of put it on your own shoulders and do everything yourself. If I do that, if I allow that worry to set in and I don't give those concerns over to God, where does it lead to, according to this verse?
Depression.
It will. It'll lead to depression. It'll absolutely... You'll allow yourself to become overwhelmed and... some of us can testify to this fact. We try to do it. We try to put it all on ourselves. We don't ask for help. We don't pray until after the fact. And then all of a sudden, you've got all this stuff on you. And it's just beating down and beating down. And it can. It can lead us to depression. And then you've got the flip side. You've got the answer, really. A good word. Godly word. Makes it glad. Makes the heart glad. I think this is one of the verses that Terry Owens used to have on her email. That last section there. A good word makes the heart glad. And is that true? Don't you love being around people who are like that? Who bring good words. They don't get caught up there. My friend Tad loves to use the phrase wet blanket. Yeah, like, oh, thanks for wet blanketing me, Lance. I appreciate that. I was all excited about this. I was on fire for it. And you just wet that blanket and threw it right on it and put it out. And he messes with me all the time. These people here are the opposite of that. They stoke the flames. They make you more zealous. And they're excited and they're happy and they enjoy life. And I take it from the context that these are godly people. These are not just chipper people. These are people who are happy because they trust in the Lord. They bring a good word. They bring His word. And that makes the anxiety and the depression. It pushes it away. It cuts through the darkness, if you will. Any other comments on any of those? Why do you think, I don't know the technical historical answer to this. I think we can make a good guess. Why do you think midweek Bible studies came about? I mean, there's certainly nothing in Scripture that says, you know, you guys must come together on Wednesdays. But God's people have chosen to do that. Why do you think that came about?
The early church met from house to house daily. And so this is just another way of getting people to come together to study God's Word that otherwise they probably wouldn't.
Bob?
I think it helps us to grow spiritually because I might be struggling with a problem that I don't know how to solve, and if I come to Bible study and share it with you all, you all might give me the answer that I need.
Absolutely.
Encouragement.
Yeah. I think all of these things, if you've gone to work 3 days, chances are most of us, when we worked and when I was at the bank, most of us are not surrounded by godly people in the workplace. If you are, congratulations. I mean, that's a fantastic blessing. But for most of us, that's just not reality. Well, what happens after 3 days? All the complaining and all the backstabbing and all of the just negativity, does that affect you after 3 days? It does me. You know, you want to lock your door to your office so people can't get in, and take the phone off the hook too because it's coming that way, and don't check your emails, whatever you do, because all this stuff comes in. I can see why saints want to meet together in the middle of the week. And it doesn't matter if we have a singing or if we study, if we do both. I just want to be around my people. Just give me an hour to be recharged, to be around people who love the Lord instead of people who are just thinking about worldly stuff 24/7. Again, I don't know the historical aspect exactly why, but I would imagine it's because of a reason like that. That's why we still do it, because we need it. We need the encouragement, as Donna said. And we need the answers, as Bobby brought up as well, too.
Yeah. Lance, there was something in the news this morning when we woke up that people either are becoming atheists, and it's and the percentage is continuing to go up and up and up. And if you're not out there trying to help people not become an atheist, at least try not to become one yourself. And make sure you come to church.
Yeah, I saw that report the other day, and just how the numbers have gone up in recent years. And there are a lot of different reasons I think we can point to for that. Does the media love the Lord?
No.
I mean, you know, does television and radio, does it love the Lord? Does it promote the Lord's ways? Of course not. And then where I think a real danger is, you have children, whole generations of people being brought up in houses that don't know the Lord. They just don't know Him. they don't care. They're again caught up in their worldly pursuits. They don't have time for it, or they don't make time for Him. So what happens to the children who grow up in that? They don't make time for the Lord either. You know, mom and dad never did. Why should I? And not all. Certainly there are exceptions to that. But by and large, if you see that worldly attitude, it's very tempting to take that on and make that yours. And then we end up with a generation that knows not God. And you're Judges 2, verse 10, all over again. We can remember what happened in the period of the Judges after Joshua and the elders who knew Joshua died. You've got one generation later. It's like they fall off a cliff. They don't steadily decline at a slow rate. You've got faithful Joshua, faithful elders. They die. The people go crazy. And that's what can happen with just one generation of ungodliness. It's scary. It is. But as Donna said, we need to make sure we're making the effort that doesn't happen to us. And that doesn't happen to the children that we have influence over. Chuck.
And that goes back to the verse about the stupidity. Because too many people go to college and become professors and think they have all the answers and the Bible's outdated and whatnot, and they don't want to be told what to do with their lives.
There you go.
That's where you fall right there.
It all ties in together, doesn't it? Because, you know, if I've achieved such honor and renown for myself, and then I'm reading in the Bible and it tells me I'm wrong, I'm going to have to make a decision, right? I'm either going to agree that this Bible's right, which means I've got to change, or I'm going to say, this can't possibly be right because it's telling me I'm wrong. What a bunch of trash. Let me throw that away and tell everybody else how they need to get rid of their Bibles too. I mean, we're going to make a choice. And even if we choose, I don't care, it's really the same as that last one. I mean, you're certainly not promoting truth. You're just getting in the way of it and breeding that. In that sense, what's the word I'm looking for there? Apathy. Just breeding apathy. So either way, Satan wins and gets what he wants.
No accountability.
Yeah, yeah. And that certainly, we see that attitude in our society very prevalent. Okay, 5 minutes. Let's look at verse 26. We're actually going to talk about this idea, Lord willing, in this next hour in the sermon. Depending on the version you have, the English Standard Version says, one who is righteous is a guide to his neighbor. The New King James Version says the righteous should choose his friends carefully. Let's consider both of them because I think both of them are true. Either way is right. The righteous is a guide to his neighbor because his advice is going to be sound. It's going to be godly, and he should therefore give that heavenly wisdom to everyone he comes in contact with. Similarly, the New King James Version, the righteous should choose his friends carefully. Why?
Each friend that have the same goal he has something in common with him. But you wouldn't have anything in common with the unrighteous.
Yeah. I think you even go back to the idea we talked about on Wednesday night services. You have people with a common goal, people who will lift you up, help you serve the Lord, help you to grow and become better. That's the kind of friends we should have. Again, and we'll talk about this in the lesson. It doesn't mean that we should never, ever, ever be around the lost. You know, the only way you're going to teach somebody the truth is to have a relationship with them. And they trust you and respect the things that you're saying. So certainly there. But when our closest bonds of friendship, the very closest people to us in this world, when all of them are worldly and I'm a Christian, I probably need to start asking some questions about why. Why do I prefer to be around those who love the world? Why do I prefer their company? Again, I understand we need to have a friendship, a trustworthiness, a give and take with the lost to be able to teach them truth. But when all of my closest people are worldly, that may suggest something about me and my preferences. Why don't I choose God's people? Why don't I want to be around them more and build myself up by being around them? We'll talk about 2 Samuel 13, Lord willing, in the next hour when you see a man who made a poor choice of friends. Amnon, David's son, chose his cousin, actually, and also his friend, Jonadab, and listened to his advice. And you probably remember where that ended up getting Amnon. A couple more minutes. Okay, let's finish this section up. 27 and 28. The lazy man does not roast what he took in hunting, but diligence is man's precious possession. This is one of those things. If we are lazy, we will waste the blessings that we've been given. Here you have a man who goes out hunting, and he's successful. He kills something. And what does he do with it?
Let it spoil.
You know, I don't even feel like cooking this thing. I mean, can you imagine somebody having a huge catch, going out fishing, and just bringing a haul in? They come in, they got a cooler full, like, man, what a good day. And they throw it outside, and they leave it there for a week and a half. What would you think about somebody like that? Why did you even put the effort? Why did you put the money and the time into it? What a waste. And for people who would appreciate it, what would they think about somebody like that? How foolish is this? And yet, if we're lazy, we will waste opportunities. We'll waste the blessings that we've been given. One final verse there. In the way of righteousness is life, and in its pathway there is no death. Certainly speaking in spiritual terms. The righteous die physically too. We understand that. This is spiritual. For those who seek God's way and His path, for those who seek righteousness, there is no death spiritually for them. That is extremely comforting. Because when physical death comes, what do you have to worry about if you're righteous? You can take it. You can look forward to it in the sense that Paul did, because I get to be with the Lord. Great. One of the greatest blessings as Christians that we have. Okay, let's stop there. We'll prepare for the worship. Thank you very much for your comments.